KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Lee Hale, in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on Radio West, are you one of those people who apologizes to inanimate objects when you bump into them, whether it's a chair or a lamp, or are you more of the cursing type? Either way, we'll be discussing the question, how does the inanimate object feel in that scenario? Our guest is Ian Chillog. He's senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he just launched a new podcast called Everything is Alive.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Lee Hale, in for Doug Fabrizio. Are you one of those people that thinks about how the daily objects in your life feel? I don't mean how they feel to the touch, or how they even feel to you. I mean, how does that object, whether it's a doorknob or a toothbrush, how does it feel about what's going on around it? I can't say that's my typical state of mind, but listening to the podcast Everything is Alive has given me pause. In the show, host Ian Chillog interviews actors posing as everyday objects. A lamppost, a pillow, an off-brand can of soda. And as it turns out, these inanimate objects have a lot to say for themselves, both about what they experience, but also about us, the humans that interact with them without much of a second thought. Ian Chillog is the creator and host of Everything is Alive. He's also the senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which we'll talk about a little later in the program. He joined us from his office in Brooklyn, New York. I have to be honest with you. The premise of your show, Everything is Alive, did not quite like hook me right off the bat. I think I read the line, Everything is Alive is an unscripted interview show in which all the subjects are inanimate objects. And like the first image in my head was like a public radio producer with big headphones and a shotgun mic, like just walking aimlessly around a living room, you know, just like pointing at lamps and couches. Was it kind of a tough sell to people, the idea, when you had the initial vision?
Well, I will say you're not alone. I think a lot of people, when they saw that, the first, the kind of elevator pitch, really didn't know what to expect. I will say, you know, Radiotopia, Julie Shapiro, who I pitched the show to, just kind of immediately understood it and wanted to make it. And I think has the same, you know, I think we both feel like we haven't quite made the perfect episode and won't for a little while, but whatever that is, we have the same vision in our heads.
So she understood it. I'm just curious, where did it come from? The idea.
Well, from me. I guess it's, you know, it's kind of a way that I've always joked around, you know, thinking about how awful it must be for my chair to have the job that it has, to just be sat on by gross humans all day. But then I think there's also this thing that, you know, I've been a producer for so long and, you know, producing segments for shows where, you know, a host is wants to do an interview about, you know, say, there's maybe a new, a new bacteria in beach sand or something. And so what we would do is go find the right microbiologist who could talk about that and find the right expert. And I just kind of had this thought, like, how interesting it would be if you could just talk to the sand itself, like get the true primary source,
cut out the middleman.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's one of those shows that talking about it makes a lot less sense than listening to it, I've found. So yes. I want people to hear this. We're going to play a little bit from the beginning of your conversation with Lewis, and Lewis is a can of knockoff can of soda.
Yes. Well, let's just start, settle in, have you introduce yourself for us.
My name is Lewis, and I am a can of Go-To Cola.
That's a store brand.
Mm-hmm. Go-To, G-O-2, Cola.
So it's similar to Coca-Cola.
Similar. People call it a knockoff. I've been called the best of the worst. You know, if you wanted to get my honest opinion, I believe in a blind taste test. Your average person wouldn't be able to tell the difference between me and a can of regular Coca-Cola, but... Yeah, bottom shelf, We can describe it comfortably as bottom shelf. I'm at peace with that.
Literally on the...
Most of the time, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there's a lot I want to talk to you about today. Do you need water or anything?
No, I'm completely self-contained.
It answers the age-old question, what happens when you give a can of Coke a glass of water? Or offer, right?
Yeah.
So the thing that's interesting to me is that we're living in a time right now where people are, you know, at times struggling to see other people as human, and yet you're inviting us to see objects as human, right? I'm just curious, like, what's the hope or the objective with this? Like, you know, you talked about the initial idea was I want to cut out the middleman. What do you hope the listener's experience is when they get to meet somebody like Lewis, who's a go-to cola?
Well, I think that the objects, for the most part, are these things that generally kind of melt into our background. You know, we don't think about a lamppost and we don't think about a can of cola. It's just kind of there. And so you know, when you give them this personality, they become these great observers of us because there are these things that we're not self-conscious around because we don't imagine they're paying any attention. And so I think that, you know, there's opportunities that they can sort of be seeing things about us that maybe we don't see. I think as a producer of the show, my goal is just that you kind of believe it, you know,
yeah.
That it within a few minutes, you don't think about how weird it is, but that you're just, yeah, this is a pillow talking to me about its life.
Right. Which is a tall order. Right. To get them out of that space. But I think I noticed, especially with Lewis, you just kind of jump right in. Right. You hit the play button and you're just kind of there with him. There isn't a lot of revving up or a lot of explanation. You just kind of want people to be there with him.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I've you know, the second episode, which is with a lamppost named Maeve, has a slightly more, produced beginning. And I actually find there's something about just hearing a voice, like just really jumping right in, that makes it easier to become convinced. And I think it's because, you know, the less you imagine the hands of somebody making the thing, the less you think about, oh, somebody decided to play music here or something like that.
Right.
It's easier to believe.
Right. At the risk of taking this podcast, which is, you know, inherently funny and hilarious and trying to get too much meaning out of it, I mean, when you're talking about the things we don't acknowledge, the things we ignore, the things that are very fundamental to our lives, would you say that people are generally kind of careless? I mean, was your hope also that we just might? I mean, because to be honest, I think Maeve, the lamppost, says something about how she wanted to be a flashlight so that her human could like take her around and so she could see the world. And I couldn't help myself but think like, oh, am I taking the objects I own and like taking them on trips? Like, am I showing them my world? But I'm wondering, did you want people to come away thinking like, oh, I want to be a little more mindful and careful of what I consume or what I own? Was that part of the motivation at all too?
Not really. I mean, I think we just want to make these characters and you know, we want them to have something, each of them different, something different to say about, you know, human life and object life.
Right.
I will say though, you know, as the show's come out and we're getting all these responses, a lot of people are saying things like, you know, I was sad to drink my Diet Coke at the end of the day today because I thought about Lewis. And, you know, so it's not empathy for humans exactly, but it is more empathy or sympathy at least. And I don't know, that feels right.
Right. I want to get back to the responses in a little bit, but first just, you had to logistically figure out how to do this show, right? You had this initial idea. And I guess at some point you realized I need people to play these objects and I need people who are witty and quick on their feet. It sounds like, I mean, the people you interview, they're funny and they seem very, very, very thoughtful at the same time. How did you initially think that was going to have to be the case? And how did you go about finding these people?
Yeah, I knew it was going to have to be people who were very quick on their feet and funny. You know, the show it doesn't necessarily, in terms of my goals, it doesn't have to be funny. I like that it is, and I want it to be funny, but the goal is just that it feels, you know, again, it feels real as it can. And so the challenge in casting, because we do want funny people, is talking to people that are playing the objects about how you don't need to be making people laugh. Like, I know those are your skills, and those are great skills, but what we want is to really think about, you know, what this thing might be going through. And so to kind of attack the character with less of a laugh line goal and more of, a slightly more introspective goal.
Right. I guess when you're not going for the laughs, maybe it makes the laughs more genuine, right, along the way?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we are certainly guilty and of an awful pun here and there. I think like at least one in each episode. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly not all high minded, but yeah, you know, if it comes out of a situation, comes out of a genuine interaction, it's just like all of it contributes to it keeping you in the moment. You know, the second you realize something is making a joke, a conscious joke, it takes you out of the suspension of disbelief. And a lot of our edits, like the final edits that I make in the episode are, oh, that's so funny, but you know what? We're just making a joke. Mm. And you can hear it.
Interesting.
And those are the things that have to go.
Well, I want us to hear a little more. Can you just set this up? Tell us who Maeve is.
Maeve is a lamppost who lives in Brooklyn, and she, being three stories tall, she has this vantage point where she can see into apartments. And the apartment that she looks into, they watch a lot of television, which just captivates her.
It's like an older, it would have been like my ancestors, I guess, featured in Singing in the Rain, it's called.
Yeah.
That's a
kind of famous lamp. He swings around, if I remember. He grabs the lamppost and swings around.
Oh, yeah. The lamppost is the lead in that movie. So that's what's cool for all of us to see that.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, there's some people, but I don't think they matter. Like, it's just like there's a cast of people, dancers, I think they are. And then it's mainly about the lamppost and the rain. Now, I didn't hear, we can't hear the movie. So, from what I understand from seeing that movie through the window is these anonymous actor dancer people, they see this most beautiful, sturdy looking lamppost and they celebrate it by dancing. Like I said, I don't know, but I think what they're saying is like, looking at the lamppost and here we go.
Yeah, I think.
What, like, a beautiful lamppost and look at him.
Uh-huh.
It's a male lamppost, I think.
I don't know.
There's a little bit of Maeve in all of us, right? I love the fact that this is a lamppost watching a movie. And of course, the lamppost must be the lead character, right?
Yeah, yeah. Maeve is an unreliable narrator.
and with that, I mean, yeah, I'm kind of curious about the writing process here a little bit. You're saying you said it's not scripted, right?
That's right.
So, are these moments like this? Do you just kind of stumble into it with these actors? I mean, is this kind of like a little? I mean, because these moments seem like they're exactly where you want to go. But I mean, is this just kind of? Were you expecting her to take it that way?
No. So the way it works is, I will have a conversation with our actor a couple days before the actual interview. And it's just 15, 20 minutes on the phone where we talk about basic character notes. Like, well, do you think it would be, where do you think it would live? And do you think it would be an introvert or an extrovert? And maybe start thinking about what being stuck in one place and being very tall might do to your personality. And I don't ask for the answers to those questions, but we talk a little bit about it. And then, you know, they take that and spend a couple of days just turning it over in their mind. And that helps develop the character.
Gotcha.
Maeve, I had this idea when I thought it would be fun to interview a lamppost, that the kind of the compelling thing would be that she was obsessed with the lost dog posters that got taped to her. And that she always heard about dogs that were missing, but nobody ever told her what happened. And so she was just kind of filled with worry all the time. And that's what I thought that episode was going to be. Maeve, of course, found this completely different and wonderful place. And we just kind of followed that.
Right. Somebody that's obsessed with movies. Also somebody that makes some pretty cutting judgments and some keen insights into the people walking by. Like one line that kind of tripped me up a little bit, made me think, was she says she can notice people balding before they notice that they're balding even. And that she sees some people who walk with the confidence of a full-headed person without realizing that.
Yeah.
As somebody with a receding hairline, that really cut me deep.
You and me both.
But with that being said, you know, there are moments that are funny and make you think. There's also moments that just make you think. I mean, there seems to be some like real, it was weird to call it honest because you're talking to a can of soda, for instance. But Lewis in particular, the cola, gets pretty existential, or at least you kind of go there with him, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Is that where you expected that conversation to go?
Well, one thing, you know, that we came upon is that Lewis being a generic cola was not going to be the most desired cola.
Right.
And so he was going to have a lot of time on the shelf before anybody picked him up. So he's going to have a lot of time to think. And so, you know, would naturally maybe become a thinker. And that's where Lewis took it. And I thought it was great.
Right. Cause I mean, he's somebody who's been kind of neglected. He wasn't consumed with the rest of his pack. Right.
Right.
And so that gives one a lot of time to think. And there's questions raised about, is he the can? Is he the soda? Is he both? What happens if a can is recycled, right?
And then
there's this one part I want to play here that I thought was, I found it really compelling. So this is you kind of having this moment where he's kind of questioning his fate.
I think about this with you because and I'm sorry if I have, this isn't the right way to put it, but it seems like your purpose is to be consumed by a human.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we all want to serve our purpose. We all want to be useful.
Yeah.
And yet for you, the moment of your use is the moment where you are no more. And I wonder if that's something you anticipate with optimism or if it feels like, you know, approaching the end.
It's a paradox, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Well, I guess on the one hand, I do sort of dread the idea of being consumed.
Yeah.
You know, all beings endeavor to persist in their own being. Spinoza said that. I heard about that from a cup of coffee. But on the other hand, I guess on some level, I still hope that I will kind of fulfill myself by being consumed, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that dream is still very much alive. Though, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, you know, I do sometimes fear that moment is past.
I feel weird saying this, but I could drink you.
We're going to leave it with the cliffhanger there.
Okay.
That's weirdly real to me. I don't know. Maybe you convinced me. Maybe I'm really in there. But that moment just felt like, I don't know what it was, but there was some real human emotion there, right?
Yeah, and it's funny, like I have no acting skills or anything, but I've certainly heard people talk about getting into character and really, you know, feeling the things that you feel, that your character feels, and that's what makes an actor a good actor. I don't know how to do any of that, but I will say during that scene I was really feeling for Lewis. They really do feel like interviews, and something about the way we're doing them, you know, I don't feel like I'm pretending. I feel like I'm interviewing the thing, and that's probably a big credit to the actors too.
I mean, I could tell you're playing it really straight, right? Is that kind of like your role, is you're there to just take it very seriously? I mean, is that the role you play?
Absolutely. Yeah. It has to be serious. It's not fun when you're joking about jokes or, you know, there can be one thing that's off going on. And I think there's something funny about, you know, the premise, I think a lot of people feel is ridiculous, that you would interview inanimate objects. And so taking a ridiculous premise and colliding it with a very serious approach to that premise is the, I don't know if it's effective, but it's a lot of fun.
Right. Well, and it's part of me, then I want you to crack, right? As a listener, it's like, how can this guy handle this for this long, right? How can he keep up? I mean, you're really good. You really don't. I mean, there's a few moments where maybe the guest or you just shows a little bit of like, you acknowledge the absurdity, even just the way that your tone, but not much more than that. I mean, there isn't any really giggling or anything like that, actually.
Yeah. I hosted this podcast with Mike Danforth, who's the EP of Wait Wait for a while, called How to Do Everything. And we had a rule that we never wanted to hear ourselves laugh. Hmm. And I think it's because with two hosts especially, I never like when I listen to something and it feels like people are having fun without me. And, you know, you always want to be included. And that's why, you know, working on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, if there are jokes that our panelists are making that where they're laughing at each other more than the crowd is laughing. So it feels like it's this thing that's happening in a room in Chicago and you're not involved.
Right.
We cut that stuff out as much as we can, because it's all about it feeling like everybody's a part of it. And I think I have an aversion to hearing that kind of enjoyment, I guess.
Right. That's very radio of you. I mean, it makes me think of Terry Gross says something similar about how she doesn't want her guests in the studio because she doesn't want to see anything that her listeners can't see, right?
Yeah. And I worked on that show for a long time, and she asks these questions that, you know, somebody would say something to you like, yeah, you know, I met this person at a party, and then we went upstairs, and, you know, and then the person would look at you and widen their eyes, and they would be communicating that something, you know, something happened in that room, and you would say, you might laugh and say, yeah, and then you would move on to the next question. But Terry never sees that. Hmm. So she says, no, what happened?
Right.
You know, which is a question you would never hear in normal conversation.
Right.
But it gets people to talk about things that they've never had to talk about because everybody else has always moved on, and yada, yada, yada. Terry is amazing.
Right. Do you like to be in the same room as your actors?
It's funny. That's what we've done so far. And, you know, there are some actors that I want to work with who are in other cities. And I've thought, you know, I don't feel like I know what I'm doing yet enough with this show to try doing it remotely. But I was talking to somebody yesterday who was mentioning the way Terry Gross does it and thinking about those prejudices that happen from seeing someone. And it might actually be a great idea, you know, to not have the prejudice of seeing a human there. So, yeah, I feel like we should try that soon.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, on the topic of Lewis and him kind of thinking about where his life ends and his purpose and that kind of thing, that stuck with me. Maybe it's because I'm a millennial and I have commitment issues, but I thought that it could be a metaphor for death, obviously, but it could be a metaphor for getting your first job or for maybe marriage, depending on who you're talking to. But this idea of like,
yeah,
this thing that I feel drawn to, I don't know how it will change me, right? And
yeah,
but I'm drawn to it nonetheless. And that was profound. Maybe I need to spend more time thinking about that personally. but I want to ask you about, first of all, can I just ask you, is there a moment that just surprised you? Like a moment you found just really delightful or just kind of a favorite moment so far in recording the show?
I mean, I do love the way that Lewis ends, and we'll just leave the cliffhanger where it ends. That felt really right and was really surprising to me. There's something that Maeve says, where we talk about the lamppost from Singing in the Rain and learn along the way the true fact that the lamppost from Singing in the Rain was stolen from a guy's front yard and went went missing and hasn't been seen for 28 years. And Maeve says this thing about, I think she says, they're not looking hard enough. They're not taping lost lamppost signs to dogs and sending them around the city. And I don't know that every time I think about that, it makes me laugh.
But not in the show, though. Obviously, you played it straight.
Never in the show.
Right? Yeah. And I should say, just, you know, as an aside here, that you do fit in some history lessons a little bit. You know, there's kind of an element of the show is there's a little bit of reporting that goes into it, too. And people can learn some facts about soda or about radiation drinks. I thought that was interesting, too. I just want to talk about, we mentioned this a little earlier, some of the reactions to the show. I've just been on Twitter and I've seen some tweets I want to read to you. One person said, things I did not expect would happen today, that a can of soda would leave me in tears, yet here I am. And then another tweet I saw was, my therapist gave me homework to listen to a podcast where a guy interviews inanimate objects. He knows me so well. Have you been surprised by the reactions? What have you been hearing, and how has it affected you?
First of all, I was so excited about I saw that one too, about the therapist prescribing everything is alive. That was so great. I've been completely surprised by the reaction. It's been overwhelming, and people are really connecting with the things. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're sometimes talking to me, but mostly they're talking to Maeve and Lewis and Dennis, and that feels great. And I don't know, I think it is, the premise does sound silly, and it is definitely silly. I want it to be silly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, we are trying to make these things think a little deeper. And I think that that's surprising to people, and that's a lot of what people are responding to.
That's Ian Chillog. He's the senior producer for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and the host of the podcast Everything is Alive. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. There's also a link at our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Lee Hale, in for Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Ian Chillog is with us. He's the creator and host of the new podcast, Everything is Alive, in which he interviews actors posing as inanimate objects. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. As much as I love your current new podcast, you work on another show. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Yes.
How long have you been with the show for?
8 years somewhere. Yeah.
Gotcha. And they're celebrating, the show is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year, correct?
True.
So is this, yes. It's a kind of a moment where it's a funny, because I mean, this is a show that does not take itself seriously, but it's a moment of reflection, right? Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a big part of a lot of people's media diets. I mean, whether it's their weekend schedule or whether it's how they cope with the news. Can you humor me a little bit and just tell me what goes into making that show happen? I mean, I know we're supposed to think that Peter is really that charismatic and that witty, but we know that not any one man can be that that on the spot every time. So just tell me what really goes into the work that goes into making that show happen every week.
Well, Peter is very witty. I will say first of all.
Okay, all right. A little bit of the credit.
He is. Yes. But yeah, it's, you know, a lot of what's good about Wait, Wait comes out of what happens, the group of us who make it, just sitting around a table and talking about what's funny to us. And the course of the week, we start out early in the week, just collecting stories, both, you know, the stories that are only funny, just funny, dumb things that people are doing. And then looking at the big stories of the week and trying to find what could possibly be funny about them. And we do that for a couple days and start thinking about what we're going to need to be talking about on the weekend. And Wednesday rolls around and we start writing up some jokes about some of the stories. And then Thursday, which is the day we tape the show, we throw out pretty much everything we wrote on Wednesday and rewrite and then record Thursday night and hope that nothing drastic happens on Friday that makes what we did the night before unusable.
Hope that it holds.
We've had... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's getting harder to do that, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah. It sure is.
What were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to say the only time I can remember that we actually had to go back in and record on a Friday was when they gave President Obama the Nobel Peace Prize, which was such a surprise. And it came out on Friday morning. And we had done a huge segment, which, because of where it was in the show, had to stay in the show. And, you know, we had talked about the big news from the Nobels, which was, you know, whatever person won the chemistry prize.
Right.
So there was no way to run what we had and not sound totally stupid. And we got Tom Baudet, I think, into a studio in Boston, and we taped this this Frankenstein of a thing that somehow I think was funny and convincing.
Wow. Not ideal, though, right, to do it that way.
Yeah, that's not what you want to do.
So, you know, it's interesting that I feel like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, what that show does well is it takes things that you might think are a little ordinary, and the show helps you see how absurd they are. But now it seems like now a lot of things that just seem absurd just seem more absurd when they're joked about in the show, right? That there's a lot of the things happening in politics that just seem like, you know, nobody thought we would be here. Does it make it harder for you as somebody who's writing for the show, somebody who's thinking about jokes, is the fact that things just feel hectic and crazy and unexpected? Is that a gift, or is that kind of a hindrance to you as a comedy writer?
Yeah, no, it's definitely harder. The one thing is it takes away sort of a basic comedy tool, which is you take something somebody is doing, and then you say what they're doing, and then you come up with a more exaggerated, crazy version of that, and that's your joke. We cannot outdo the crazy and exaggerated that is reality right now. Like, literally, we will make a joke, and then whatever we joked about will happen a few days later in reality. So that's a challenge.
We're just living in a wait, don't tell me world now. That's what's become.
Yeah. Yeah. Just imagine like all of us have a little Roy Blunt Jr. following us around commenting on what's happening. The other thing that I find especially challenging is because I think people are so hungry for jokes about Donald Trump, and a lot of people are hungry for jokes that sort of try to take him down a peg, that you can get a laugh out of something that is not a joke. You can just make a reference. Mm-hmm. And because people are so excited about it, they'll laugh. Like, you can just say, you know, and because he has tiny hands, or because he wears a hairpiece, or, you know, whatever. He's only on the golf course, whatever it is.
Right.
And they're just facts, or, you know, and because you get this reward, we could go and probably do a show where we don't come up with anything new and don't say anything substantive, don't have any take on things, and still, you know, still have enough laughs to string together a show. But that would be so depressing.
Yeah.
You know, it's so...
Well, not very fun. That wouldn't be very fun, right? For your case.
Yeah, definitely. And... you know, because we always want there to be some substance, and we always want to be saying something new. And so, you know, I think we have to remind ourselves, yeah, that joke will work, but we can let's do something better.
Right.
But, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
You guys don't hold back when it comes to President Trump in particular, and it's a and it made me think of this experience I had recently, which is I was here in Salt Lake City talking to a gun activist, somebody who is pro-gun, and they are part of an organization, and they told me, you know, in this conversation that the Salt Lake Tribune, one of our major papers here, was very, very, very unfair and untrustworthy, and they got nothing right when it came to what he was doing, right? And he kept on going on and on and on about how bad their coverage is. And the Salt Lake Tribune is a really great paper, and I know the reporters there, and they're very good reporters, and he kept on going on. And then I realized he was talking about a political cartoon. All of this feeling about the Tribune was because they had written, they basically, there's this cartoonist there, he's very talented, Pat Bagley had done a cartoon, and did not put them in a very good light. And I thought in that moment, you know, I was thinking about how that affects the credibility of the whole Tribune. And in some ways, Wait, Don't Tell Me is kind of like NPR's political cartoon, right? You know, you have all these really hardworking journalists who are trying really, really hard to be objective and fact find, and then you guys come in on the weekends and you just kind of blow it all up, right? and I wonder, you know, I think a lot of people are very grateful for you and that you know, the fact that we, you know, when everything feels so serious, it's nice to kind of to laugh about something. But do you ever worry a little bit that you're making the job of people who are at NPR a little harder? Because, I mean, you're all part of the same family. Do you worry about that? Or if you did, would that just kill the funny and you can't go there?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say I don't think we're any harder on Trump than anybody else. It's just the volume of stories that are coming out are Donald Trump right now. And those are the things we're talking about. And, you know, there are crazy and surprising things happening. But I think, you know, if you look at the sort of proportion of news, I think we're equally hard on, or we're equally commenting on, you know, anybody doing things in, you know, as a public figure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That said, there's so much that's Trump, so it feels like a lot of Trump, which I understand.
Well, but, it creates a really strong slant, and I know that Trump is different than the typical president. But you know, you do give your comics, your panelists, a lot of freedom, right? And that also means freedom to voice their opinions. I mean, maybe it's just impossible to not seem slanted right now, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you know, there's all these things that everybody's talking about right now, like, you know, if you're talking about white supremacists, you know, the right thing to do is not to find a white supremacist and then find someone who is not a white supremacist and say that the truth is in the middle. Like, that's not, like, white supremacy is wrong. Like, there are certain things that are fine to say. I think that, you know, in terms of our panel and in terms of what we do slant wise, I think that one thing that's very important to us is that nothing we say make people clap, you know. We talk about clappers on the show.
Interesting.
And sometimes somebody will say a joke that is more making a point and the crowd will applaud. We will avoid that, and when it happens we will cut it if at all possible. And also, what the thing that all of us, Peter, Mike, Miles, Jennifer, everybody on staff, the thing we like the most is a joke that makes people boo and then laugh. Something that sort of challenges, like, our, you know, what our audience's prevailing beliefs might be, but then is funny enough that, you know, you can hear that fade. Like, that's the victory.
I think that what you said about clappers is really interesting, because it's in one sense you want to feel like when you're at a Wait, Don't Tell Me show or listening that you're all part of the team together. At least there's a camaraderie there. But I guess you don't want that to be the thing that you're known for, right? You don't want people to come there and say, we're just gonna validate your feelings and kind of push you along the path you're already on. It sounds like that's what I'm hearing from you.
That's a nightmare. Yeah.
And is that also just problematic for comedy? And I mean, there's, like, maybe I'm almost sensing like an ethical reason to do that. But I mean, are you being better comics if you don't do that as well?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you know, if you're not bringing up a new idea, then what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or at least like a new perspective on something we see.
There's something that was just released that surprised me a little bit because again, with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's not a super reflective show. I mean, it's really just kind of a reactive show, which is why people love it. But Faith Staley and Mo Rocca just sat down to do this interview, and I think it's called Naked and Ashamed is the series, right?
I haven't heard this.
Oh, you haven't heard this? Okay, well, I'll fill you in then. So Faith Staley, who's a panelist, along with Mo Rocca, they're familiar panelists to those who listen to the show, both comics. And they sit down just to talk about the show, with its 20th year anniversary, what their experience has been as panelists. And Mo Rocca says some pretty interesting things, because Faith Staley's the one interviewing Mo. And Mo talks about how he came to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Uh-huh. And he says when he was there, he felt like he was really kind of had this arch stereotype where he had to fill, where he kind of had to be. He just felt like there was a set way to be funny on that show. And he says, it wasn't really the way I wanted to be funny. And when he came to Wait, Wait, he realized that character wasn't going to work. And he said that he had to realize, you know, he basically had this chance to experiment with his own voice. And he gives a compliment to the producers. And he says that the producers on that show give people a little bit of room to breathe. He says in particular, that oftentimes you guys will leave in tangents that he thought for sure they would cut. He says there was one tangent about seeing a guy, I guess, walk out of the O'Hare Airport in Chicago with a deep dish pizza and how disgusting that was to him. He said, as I said, I knew they were going to cut it, and they didn't cut it. And he says, it felt like, wow, they really want me to be me on this show. I thought there was something profound about that.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear. And we do, you know, it's, we want a diverse group of people saying things with diverse takes and in Mo's case, tangents about deep dish pizza. Mo is a master of the tangent, and we love Mo's tangents. I think, you know, that's the whole thing is that those panelists, that's three different perspectives on whatever we're talking about. And then you add in Peter's perspective and Bill's perspective and the, you know, the collision of those things is so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, Mo and Faith said something. I wanted to see what you thought about this. I guess Mo said it. I think he said that he thinks what makes the show good is that when he sits down with the panelists, they like each other. Like they show each other pictures of the grandkids and they joke and they have these inside jokes with each other before the show starts taping. Is that part of the magic of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, that you're putting people together that just would genuinely probably choose to spend time with each other if they had a choice?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's, you know, there's definitely, I think, a family dynamic to the staff of the show, a funny and dysfunctional but loving family. And I think that and the fun that we have and the way we care about each other, I think that comes across. I think also the show it's never mean. It's almost never mean. And I think sometimes people will use the word snarky, which isn't the right word for the show. I think that they're in, you know, as much as we love those boo laughs, I think there's a kindness in the show that comes out. We want every voice on the show to feel good, whether that's the panelists or Peter and Bill or the people who call in to play the games or the celebrity guests. I think there's a warmth that is always there, and that probably, as you said, does come from, you know, the people on the show really liking each other.
Right. Well, I mean, when it comes to President Trump, I don't think kindness is the first word that comes to my mind, but
fair enough.
I know you do bring on politicians as guests, and those are Democrats, sometimes they're Republicans, right? It seems like you do try to pull from different areas.
Yeah, we, in terms of a politician, like, if they will do the show, we will have them. Hmm. That is the criteria. Hmm. We don't care if they're a Democrat or Republican, but if they're willing to come in, come on, we'll have them.
Has it been harder to get yeses to that recently?
I actually don't. I don't know the answer to that question because I have very little to do with the booking of the show.
Gotcha.
But yeah, when I did have more to do with it, it's always a challenge because I think when people hear what we're trying to do, if they're not familiar with the show, they're afraid we're going to try and make them look stupid. I think if you know the show, you know we're not going to do that. And the amount, as far as the quiz is concerned, the amount of hints that Peter Sagal gives a guest,
right,
to help
right.
them, we want everyone to win.
Yeah.
And sometimes they insist on losing, but
right.
it's not because we want them to.
I've noticed he does this thing where he says, "You're sure." Answer C, you sure? And it's usually yeah. usually a clue, don't choose that answer.
Yeah.
So, and 20 years in, it seems like the show is as popular as it's ever been. You know, it reaches around 6 million listeners worldwide. Is that correct? Does that sound right?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Have you noticed have you noticed anything growing as far as a need for the show or an attraction to the show? Or have you noticed anything change recently in that way?
I don't know. I think people are, you know, right now, for whatever reason, people want to feel, they want something that feels good. And, we're hearing from people who just say, you know, thank you for making something that feels good. I hear that about the new show too, which is really nice. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the response in our audience going up or down, but, certainly, I think we're hearing from people that find the show a very important part of their life, which is great.
Right. I want to talk to you a little bit here. It's about your own voice. You know, producing a show can be kind of a thankless job. I mean, it can be a fun job, right? But you've spent a lot of time as a producer, and I know you've done a little bit of reporting for NPR, maybe for other outlets. But largely, a lot of what you've done in your career has been, you only hear your name in the credits, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
So with this, I mean, they had the podcast before. I think it's called How to Do Everything, right?
Yep.
And then, but with this show, it feels like you're really front and center with this new podcast. Is it interesting to be somebody who is always, I mean, who's been the producer, has been the one kind of helping a host along, helping a show work, kind of solving problems? Is it interesting for you to now step into the host seat and be the person that you might need a little? Be the one that needs a little bit of help or some assistance? Has that been an interesting switch for you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's scary. It's so much easier, especially, you know, when you're making a joke that is on the line of taste or something, it's so much easier to put that in somebody else's mouth. so, you know, there's a security in being behind the scenes. But I think that when I was producing Fresh Air way back when, a few times I subbed in on to host the weekend edition of that show when Terry was out. And I realized the first time I did that, within the first 20 minutes I did that, I realized all these things that somebody hosting a show needs that as a producer I should have been providing, but just never thought about because I had never thought about it from the other side. And it made me think that anybody doing any job, I think whether you're making a show or, I don't know, working in a law firm or whatever, everyone should probably spend a day doing everyone else's job so they understand it. And then when you go back to the thing that you're supposed to be doing, it makes you so much better at it because you just understand everyone else's needs.
I feel like maybe a hard thing though would be, do you accept help? I mean, you're probably somebody who could just do most of it all on your own, right? You're kind of like the one man band. But do you allow yourself to let people in and help you along in producing this new thing?
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, we're a tiny team making this show. I do find it hard, especially with an idea that's so new and still kind of figuring out what it is. I find it hard to trust other people with it. So I end up doing, you know, a lot of the work. And I think that'll get easier as sort of some parts of the show establish as you know, regular things. But there's also been an incredible community of people who have provided edits on the show and listened and heard things that I didn't hear. And that having other people listen and give notes has been a crucial part of the show, you know, being what it is.
And then finally, are you is there an object you're really looking forward to that you've had a hard time booking or that you're hoping to get on soon?
I mean, I've said before, the dream object, I feel like episode 100 of the show, the final episode, is an Ice Cube played by Ice Cube. I think that I'm so excited for that to happen. That's the dream. Whenever we get that done, we'll just end the show and call it a day.
We'll be listening for it. Ian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Ian Chillog. He's senior producer for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and he has a new podcast called Everything is Alive. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard produce the show. Doug Fabrizio is our executive producer. I'm Lee Hale.